Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
My name is Steve Binder. Being in television as a kid was a total accident. My father had was working in a gas station downtown Los Angeles. My mother was, in those days, a typical housewife. We had very little money. I never knew or considered as a child our financial status in the community. So we always had three meals a day and a roof over our heads. And when I went to school, I knew I wanted, I grew up in a family of great values. Though both my parents, I don't think ever graduated high school, they preached tolerance and the golden rule and to each his own. Because I think it's really important as a child that your foundation at home has a great deal to do with your adulthood and your future. And when I went to school, I was more interested in having fun, going to the park and playing football and baseball. I didn't think of having to survive on my own and make a living. But when I did graduate from high school, I registered at the University of Southern California, and I registered in pre-med, not because I wanted to be a doctor necessarily. I couldn't stand dissecting frogs or rabbits, but I wanted to make my parents proud and repay them for the beautiful childhood that I had. I have an older sister who dedicated her life to teaching. She taught at UCLA until the day she retired. It was my mother who encouraged me to take a few classes in telecommunications while I was at the university. I had joined the Air Cadets, which was the Air Force version of the ROTC at the university, and they supplied us with books and uniforms and lectures. I signed a two-year contract because in those days I thought I wanted to be a pilot, and I had 20/20 vision. After the Vietnam War broke out, the Air Force decided that for this training they were giving us, 2 years wasn't enough, and they insisted we re-sign our contracts to double that, 4 years. And my father convinced me there was a lot of difference between two and four. And so I dropped out of the Air Force ROTC, and I was immediately drafted, and I was immediately put into the medical corps in the Army and during basic training because of my college background. I was very, very fortunate. I had the opportunity to meet the commanding officer of the Blue Danube Network in Austria. He said to me, I was on a two-day leave right after basic training, and he said to me, "Give me your name, rank, and serial number, and I'll see if I can get you transferred." And sure enough, I ended up becoming a radio announcer, ironically with George Clooney's dad. He was in Frankfurt, Germany. I started in Salzburg, Austria, ended up in Nuremberg, Germany, and Munich, Germany. When I came home, I thought I wanted to get into radio. By that time, I was waiting to get back into college, but it was in the middle of a semester. So a friend of mine who was working at Paramount suggested that I get a job at any of the studios because he said, aside from filling the time waiting to get back into the university, you'll have an opportunity to be a lot of pretty girls. They're walking around a lot all over the place, and you're single, and you may meet somebody. And so I applied for the mailroom at the local KABC affiliate in Los Angeles, and I applied at CBS as a clerk typist. Though I was faking my typing skills, I'd only taken one class, I think, in junior high school, and they were looking for somebody who could type, 100 words a minute or so. I was probably at 20, and the next day I got a call from KABC saying a job was open in the mailroom. Would I be interested in interviewing? And I was interviewed by the head of the mail department, who wanted me to swear that I never wanted to do anything in life but deliver mail. And he was looking for loyalty. And with my fingers crossed behind my back, I told him that's all I wanted to do. And I got a job delivering mail on the lot. I delivered mail to the program director of KABC, a gentleman named Selig Seligman, who his past, he was an attorney and had served at the Nuremberg trials after World War II in Germany. And he was sitting at his office and he asked me to sit down and he said, "What do you want to do? What are you doing here?" And I said, "I want to be sitting in your chair interviewing you." And he laughed. And believe it or not, and I won't get into detail on it, but about 2 weeks later, I became a full director for KABC, directing a slapstick comedian show called Soupy Sales. And we threw a lot of pies on that show. And that was the launch pad. I was having so much fun. I was saying, I'm surprised there. In those days, I think I was earning about $100 a week. But, money didn't mean anything to me at that time. And I had the time of my life. I was directing the show that became very successful, and it went on the network. And the first show I did on the network was with Frank Sinatra. And the next thing is, and I won't bore you, but I decided to go freelance. I was fortunate to meet and work for Steve Allen. And I did a jazz series hosted by Oscar Brown Jr. with, we did 26 of the greatest jazz artists in America at that time. Stan Kenton, Cannonball Adderley, I could just go on and on, Nancy Wilson. And it was very successful. And in the middle of that, Steve called and said, "I just made a deal to do a 90-minute a night, late night show for Westinghouse, and I'd like you to direct it." And so for 2 years, I was on Steve's show. And that's when I did, during a hiatus, I did the Tammy show with the Rolling Stones and all these rock and roll acts. And there was an article written in the Los Angeles Times with my picture of saying who had the greatest job in television. And the writer, Cecil Smith, who was the entertainment director at the LA Times, just raved about my doing both of these shows. And then the door opened up. And from that point on, I never stopped working. Here I am in my, I think, sixth decade of actual working in the industry, with hardly a vacation of my own, and loved every minute of it. And couldn't wait to wake up in the morning and go to work, and hated to come home at night. But along the way, I did manage to have two marriages, two daughters. I've been in an incredibly wonderful marriage for the last almost 30 years. And, so I've had this incredible life that was never expected and never planned.
That is beautiful, and congratulations on 30 years. That's amazing.
Well, ironically, I met my wife by going to the movies, and I saw her in a little film called Lifeguard, fell in love with her on the screen, and then it took me a while to even track her down or find her. And she asked me when we spoke for the first time, she said, "Is this a business call or a social call?" And I hesitated a moment, but I told her the truth. I said, "I'm calling for social reasons." And she said, "Steve, it's great that you did, because if you told me it was business and then tried to date me, I would never, ever go out with you. So it pays to be honest."
Yeah, valuable lesson, valuable lesson. So I'll just jump into some questions. So you've worked with some of the industry's greatest when it comes to musicians, rock stars, just Motown, everything under the sun. Can you talk about like some of the, when you were first starting out in your career, some of the bigger names that you started to work with in the beginning?
Well, what really triggered major success for me creatively. I was doing a show in New York for NBC called Hullabaloo, which was the ABC had a competitive show called Shindig at the time, but they were the first kind of rock and roll shows that were being broadcast in prime time on two networks. And I did Hullabaloo. We had the actual stars who were in those hit records on the show, and we had guest hosts every week. It was far from what I call a real rock and roll show that we would go to pay money to go to a concert today. But from there, I got an offer to direct a hero of mine that I had grown up when I wasn't in the business at all. And I got an offer to direct the Danny Kaye show. Danny was an international superstar. And I learned a great lesson from that show, because we hit it off like oil and water. We did not agree on anything. And as a result, I made a determination I was only going to do shows that I really believed in. The talent I really wanted to work with, and they wanted to work with me. And from there, started a trilogy of specials that I did. The first one was with a major black star in New York named Leslie Uggams. And Leslie had done a television series with a choir director named Mitch Miller. And it was kind of a funny, it was a funny show. I'm sorry about the interruption, but let me take it off the hook. The first one was with Leslie Uggams. Leslie was a television star on a series where it was kind of funny, where the audience would follow the bouncing ball and they would have the lyrics on the screen. And it was very successful, evidently. This was in the 1950s. And she was at the time starring on Broadway in a show called Hallelujah Baby. And so I did a Leslie Uggams show and quite proud of it. We did it in New York. I started gathering the people I wanted to work with behind the scenes. And after we did the Leslie Uggams show, I got an offer to work with Petula Clark, an English singer. And I booked Harry Belafonte on the show, who I always wanted to work with. And we did what turned out to be a very controversial special, because it was the first time in primetime variety that a black person and a white person actually physically touched each other. And it created an international news story in Time Magazine and Newsweek and what have you became very controversial. And that's what triggered my getting the Elvis Presley special, which now has become even more famous than when I did it. The legendary concept was the Colonel had decided after Elvis came out of the army that he wanted Elvis to become more of a middle of the road television star like Perry Como or an Andy Williams, who were very successful doing family shows in prime time. And the Colonel insisted that Elvis do a Christmas special with 20 Christmas songs. And when I was brought in to produce and direct this special, I and my think tank of a fabulous behind the scenes people that I had hired to do the writing and the costuming and the sets and what have you, we sat in a room and kind of picked each other's brains on what the show should be. And we all decided we didn't want to do a Christmas special. We wanted to bring Elvis back to his roots when he did the Hound Dog and Blue Suede Shoes and what have you. And it's now referred to as the Comeback Special, but it triggered a resurrection of Elvis's career and truly transformed him into not just the public, but the singers in the rock and roll world and the critics in the rock and roll world acknowledging that he truly was the king of rock and roll, at least for the white community. Unfortunately, a lot of the black artists like Little Richard and Chuck Berry and so forth were basically ignored at the time. And most of the white artists were just covering black songs and having huge success by performing them and so forth. And with those three shows, I never had to worry about working again in the business. That I was very, very fortunate, and even sidetracked myself to get into the recording business. I had my own record company in the 70s and brought over, discovered Seals and Crofts and brought over Rick Springfield from Australia. And I realized early on as a television director that sound was being ignored in television. Most executives felt because the speakers were so small, nobody would pay attention to the sound. And it didn't make any sense to me because I was listening to radio in my car, which had a smaller speaker than my television set. And so I partnered up with a very successful record producer named Bones Howe. And Bones helped me in the television world, and I got involved in his record world, and it was a great combination. Instead of using the Bob Hope musicians that NBC could get for a very cheap price, we insisted upon using studio musicians, which eventually now are very famous themselves, called the Wrecking Crew. And these guys played on all the records for the recordings for the Beach Boys, for you name the acts in the 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s. And they were the guys who just worked from early in the morning till late at night recording the soundtracks for their songs. And then the actual acts would go out on the road and perform those records themselves.
That's amazing. And Carole K from the Wrecking Crew, you have a female
He
bassist.
was. Hal Blaine was on drums. There was so many. Tommy Tedesco on guitar. Every single musician was a star in
That's
his own
great.
right.
That's great. So I wanted to know, What was that call like when you were initially contacted regarding Elvis's comeback? How did that process kind of go about for you?
I actually, after I had completed doing the Elvis special, I got an offer to do a feature film with a major film producer. His name was Walter Wanger, and Walter was famous for his 1950s movies primarily. And he approached me, and he had an idea with a book that he had optioned. And I thought at that point, hey, maybe I'll leave television and just do feature films. And unfortunately, in the middle of pre-production, he had a heart attack and passed. And as a result, I focused on television. First of all, in a film director's career, I think you have the opportunity, maybe in a lifetime, to do 10 movies at maximum. And in television, you could do 100. And so I wanted to be busy. I wanted to make a statement. I've had such great opportunity and to be so eclectic and do so many different things. Hey, I go back to directing Gilligan's Island. I did a couple of episodes. And in all truth, the reason I did it, I wanted to learn film, and I wanted to learn 35 millimeter film. And I had a great director of photography who taught me so much. In fact, I will make a statement that if you don't try and bluff it, if you're honest and tell people you don't know something but you want to learn, they're more than anxious to help you. And I've been helped all along my career in every project I did. I even executive produced Pee-wee's Playhouse for 2 years, and we had half an amateur crew and half a professional crew, and everybody learned from everybody else, and it was a great experience. And so I encourage people who do want to get in the business is it's not sitting in bars bragging about being in show business. It's hard work. And you've got to be the first one there in the morning and the last one to leave at night. And you got to love it with a passion. And I've seen lots of people come and go in my career. But I wouldn't trade one day of being on that stage and directing for just about any. I look and say, what else would I have done if I didn't fall into this directing career? And I became a hyphenate as a producer director strictly because I got tired of frustrated producers who really wanted to be directors whispering in my ear how to do things. I wanted control over my projects.
Before I let you go, I'll go with a couple more questions, but one of the last questions is, can you describe or share a memory with you and Elvis that is like one that might stand out above all the other ones?
Well, I was convinced from the very first day that we started working on the show. The Colonel kept insisting all the way through that he wanted to end the show with a Christmas song. And I wanted Elvis to make a statement at the end of the show. We'd spent a few months with Elvis, both collectively and individually, and we really learned a lot about him. As a human being. And I wanted to find a song. I knew the Colonel wouldn't let Elvis make a goodnight speech. So I wanted to disguise it in a song. And I was looking for days at every song and listening to the lyrics. And I couldn't find anything that really fit. And the Colonel wanted me to do an old 1950s Frankie Lane song called I Believe, which had nothing to do with Christmas. I didn't understand that one. And I went to my musical director, Billy Goldenberg, and my choral director, Earl Brown, and I said, guys, go home and write the greatest song you've ever written. But you know Elvis, we all know Elvis, and try to express in the lyrics how Elvis felt about his fellow man, the world, et cetera, et cetera. They went home, and a few days later, I got a call saying they thought they had the song. I met them at NBC in Burbank, and in four bars of the music, I knew that was the song that I wanted to do with Elvis. But now I had to convince Elvis and overcome the Colonel. And so I called Elvis in, and Billy Goldenberg was a wonderful pianist, and he sat at the piano, and Earl was a great vocalist, and they sang this original song. And Elvis listened to it, and he said, play it again. And they played it again. In the meantime, the Colonel wandered in with his entourage, and I could hear him through the door saying, over my dead body, Elvis is never going to sing that song. And anyway, the song turned out to be If I Can Dream. And Elvis looked at me after he'd heard the Colonel say what he said. And Elvis looked at me in the eye and he said, I'll do it. Immediately, Colonel Parker and his the head of publishing came into the dressing room where we were with the piano. And he'd already filled out contracts for the guys to sign, giving all their music rights to him. And Billy Goldenberg, my musical director, who I used a lot in my career, he said, I gotta be honest, I didn't write this song at all. Earl wrote both the music and the lyrics. And he took a pencil with an eraser and erased his name off the lead sheet. That probably cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars in income that he could have gotten by just leaving his name on there. But the guys I surrounded myself with had great integrity. You know, we loved each other literally until their death. There are only two of them, two of us that are even alive today. And that's Jane McAvoy, my art director, and myself, all of the inner circle of creative minds that I started out with Hullabaloo, have all passed away, unfortunately. But it was the greatest experience of my life. And, you know, I'm amused now by all the millionaires that have profited from that special and spun off of it with their own Elvis projects. You know, nobody can ever take away from any of us the experience of being with Elvis and doing that 68 comeback special.
The 68 comebacks, I mean, it was a work of art. It was just unbelievable. And when you were doing it, were you guys aware that it was going to be such a quintessential part of culture, not just pop culture, but just transcend? Were you aware that it was going to be something so special that echoed in time?
Absolutely not. we just wanted to do the best we could for the artists we were working with and had no clue the results, because that was not in our hands or our control. And, you know, we were proud we did it. We did what we wanted to do without compromise. And the results speak for themselves, but it all happened almost against you know, the will of NBC. When I put together a 90-minute version, because NBC only wanted a 60-minute version, and that was the contract called for. And so on my own, I put a 90-minute version together so I could have more of the improv in it. And it was just by an accident when NBC, upon Elvis's passing, had Anne Margaret host a 3-hour special, and they asked a gopher to go into the vault and get the comeback special. And that person obviously had no clue of the history of the show, went down to the vault, and there sitting on a shelf was my 90-minute version, and pulled it and came upstairs, and that's what they aired. because the original version was so heavily edited by NBC. They took out the bordello sequence, and they were fighting me all the way in terms of airing the show that I wanted aired. But eventually, everything turned out the way I wanted it to, and the rest is in that cliche. The rest is history.
There you go. Okay. So before I let you go, the final question I usually ask this of everyone, what kind of advice would you have for kids in this world, in this day and age, as they go on to the next chapter of their lives?
First of all, don't take no for an answer. Don't listen to AI. It's filled with misinformation. And I just the other day saw a children's show that I did decades ago called Zoobily Zoo, and nothing about the AI information on it was accurate. And I called AI Facebook on it, and they immediately admitted that they were just taking it from third-party sources and they would change everything. So be very cautious about believing what you read, especially in today's world. And if you have a goal, stick to it. Don't compromise. They may pretend to like you while you're doing exactly what they want you to do, but you'll probably never get hired again. And if you do what you want to do, even against their will, but it turns out successful, they'll be the first person at your door trying to get you to work again. So I think it's a real challenge for kids today in the world that they're growing up in. And you got to have passion. Passion is everything. And stick to your guns. Everybody respects people with integrity. They seldom respect people who are willing to bend and compromise all the time.
Thank you.